Everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
That's how it is out here.
During the next half hour, Earth on the Air's grassroots contributors share stories about unusual life passages.
Young adults are transformed through vision quests and rites of passage ceremonies.
A Florida woman describes her encounters with beings from another world.
A flashback to 1972, when magic mushrooms taught a young woman how not to be a victim.
An Arizona writer contemplates the final life passage.
And more. First, here's a short story by a woman who discovers transition in a simple moment in time.
My name is Mindy Schaberg. I'm an ad manager at a community newspaper in Seattle, and I wrote these reflections a little over a year ago. I knew it was coming. I knew that my housemates, my two closest friends from college, now a year behind us, I knew we were going our separate ways at the end of the summer. I knew it in my mind, but it hadn't sunk into my heart. It was early June, and we were out at a small tavern celebrating a birthday. We were talking and laughing, people watching. I sat back in my chair, my chin in my hand, and watched my friends talking. Then Layla came on the jukebox, and I looked around at the pool table, and this redneck was lining up a shot. And suddenly, he swept down in a graceful arc, and the balls went spinning everywhere. And equally suddenly, it seemed that beauty was everywhere. That a redneck could move so gracefully seemed at once a miracle and completely natural. That we, the three of us, sitting in that bar, smoke drifting in lazy chaos from our cigarettes, foam webbed on beer glasses on the table, baskets with remnants of cheeseburgers, that we were very young, that we were just catching on, that our time together was drawing to a close, these things scared and exhilarated us. It seemed just then that no matter what seeds our souls contained, greatness or mediocrity, this moment, the redneck lining up his next shot, the three of us staring at each other with funny little smirks on our faces, Layla in the air, this moment was right. We were where we should be. And life was waiting for us, each of us, just outside the door. That was months ago, and still it resonates. I think about those pool balls, and how we three were breaking up to go spinning off, our lives ricocheting against other lives in patterns unpredicted. I think about that redneck, and I wish for the confidence and power of his simple, graceful follow-through in the things I do in my life. It seems, as I turn the moment over and over in my mind, a gift born of a collision of a few disparate elements, and suddenly the beauty of insight and understanding are everywhere. The gift of pool balls and Layla, three friends and a redneck, in a bar, on a summer evening.
My name is Suzanne Tedesco. A product of the 60s, I used to read of Yaqui Indian quests for enlightenment using psychedelic plants, and I was fascinated. At the same time, I'd grown up in a cautious family where life was a series of dangers to be avoided. So, with a mixture of fear and anticipation, I set out in September 1972 from New York City for the high mountains of southern Mexico, in search of the magic mushroom. I hooked up with a friend and two American expatriates in Oaxaca. We headed south in a VW van through high desert and mountains for the remote village of San Jose Pacifico, where the blue darumbas grow at 11,000 feet above sea level. Local people had ingested them for centuries. As we approached San Jose, an Indian man flagged us down. He spoke with my Spanish-speaking companion, smiled sweetly, and disappeared up the steep cornrows. A moment later, he returned with a handful of bluish mushrooms wrapped in a large green leaf. We thanked him and drove on to a mountain pass where we could pull over. We divided up the mushrooms and sat down to eat. After about 15 minutes, I took my new Indian blanket to a small clearing in the forest with footpaths at either side and a grove of trees framing the base. The ground was soft with pine needles, and I felt the overwhelming force of gravity press me to the ground. The sun was strong, baking me to the earth. Energy surged through my body, my back, my legs. It seemed to be radiating out in all directions from a point in my abdomen. The little grove of trees in front of me was an amphitheater with a single dancer on point. Leaves bore Aztec patterns. Suddenly, the sun went behind clouds, and squirrely animal faces popped out at me like jack-in-the-boxes. Distant bursts of thunder echoed across the valley, and I huddled safe in my trench. I must have been dozing when I heard the crackle of leaves on the path below. I sat up to find a man approaching. He stopped in front of me and began to speak in a language I couldn't understand. The next thing I knew, my mouth was fashioning syllables, forming words, and we spoke together, although I have no idea what we said. Then he stopped speaking and stepped toward me. Oh, God, he was going to rape me. I was afraid and indignant. How could he think of such a thing after our wonderful exchange? He paused for a moment, as if my reaction had stopped him, then continued to approach me, extending his hand for me to shake. Bueno, he wished me well. After he left, I managed to relax back into my reverie. Once again, I was awakened by the rustling of underbrush, this time at the head of the trail above me. I turned around and met the eyes of a large black bull, 15 feet away, preparing to charge. I was alarmed, but resolute. This was my spot, and I resented the interruption. We glared at each other in a territorial standoff. After a while, he slowly backed away, out of sight. I felt triumphant. It wasn't just that I'd held off a large, angry bull, or transformed a potential rape to a gesture of goodwill. It was what these things signified. So much of my life I'd lived as a victim, believing that the world conspired against me. I was learning that at my very core, I was powerful, and I could alter events. Since then, at times when I felt afraid or vulnerable, I've often been able to find strength, to trust myself, by remembering what the mushrooms taught me that fall day 20 years ago.
What psychedelics do is they enrich experience, which sounds trivial, except that experience is all that we have.
Ethnobotanist, writer, and explorer of the psychedelic experience, Terence McKenna.
Your understanding depends upon yourself. And this is why the drugs are so controversial, because they decondition you at the ideological level. So you just look around at the society you're in and its contradictions and preposterous assumptions are perfectly visible to you. And that frees you then to create a new world through self-experience. And this is what we should all be involved in. And this would carry us to psychological balance.
EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
The UFO is like a collective psychedelic experience, which is haunting time like a ghost. Something like 11% of the American population claim to have seen a flying saucer. Something like 30% believe they are real. the faith in the saucers is rising.
I was about 11.
This tape was sent in by a Florida listener who wishes to remain anonymous.
And early one morning, the landlord came to knocking at the door, and he asked my father if his children had been playing with matches in the backyard. And my father questioned us, and we denied it vehemently. We all knew better than to play with matches, and the landlord said that some of his tenants had reported to him that they had seen flickering colored lights in our yard the night before. And he said, I came over to look in your yard, and I want to show you. Come with me. And there was a large, charred, burned area, completely circular, about 25 or 30 feet across. My father pointed out some depressions in the earth inside the circle. As I remember him saying, it looks as if a giant cauldron has been set down here. And he said, my children couldn't have done this. Maybe it was some pranksters. And he and my father exchanged a long look, and nothing more was said.
So I think the message of the flying saucer is, or the purpose of the flying saucer, is to slow the growth of science, to allow ethics a time to catch up with it. It's like a governing device, and it says, look at the dominant ideology responsible for the cultural situation and send a force which will turn it upside down. For Roman imperialism, the flying saucer was Jesus Christ, you know. They had been expecting him for centuries, a Messiah to arise out of the tribes of Judea, and then finally, bang, somebody got the formula right, the true Messiah. The knowledge of the ancient world is destroyed. The whole thing is established. Now we have an even worse situation, the same thing, but on a global scale, a vast imperial force built on dehumanizing ideologies, economic enslavement, manipulation of the mass mind through propaganda, all of the evils of modernity, and none of the ethical maturity that you would hope would balance that out. So the cultural governor shifts into being again and says, you know, a flying saucer would turn this scene completely upside down. And it is, and it will. We may be in the pre-contact phase. Something may come out of the mass unconscious of the race that will look for all the world like a starship from another solar system, in the same way that Jesus Christ looked for all the world like God made man.
In November 1988, I was awakened suddenly during the night by the sound of my front door unlocking. So I rushed in the hallway, and what I saw there was some beings, some things beautifully backlit or glowing with a blue light. They reached out to touch me, and the next thing I remember, I was very calm, and I was escorted away, and I saw a large overhead screen with movement and colors, but I don't remember what of. Within the next few days, I tried to think about whether this had been a dream or whether this had really happened. I asked my son, who was about 7 at the time, if he had heard or seen anything that night or had any dreams that were unusual. And he said yes, he remembered a dream that he had that some friendly bat-like creatures had taken him to somewhere, and he had had a wonderful feast, and he called them the guardians. The more I thought about what had happened, I began remembering other things, that experience, that feeling of lying in bed frozen and knowing that something was approaching was a familiar feeling.
I don't want to live in one of those worlds where we all study the words of Christ or a flying saucer. I don't like these ideologically monolithic periods in history where everyone is so sure they have the answer. I think that part of the maturity of the human species has to do with evolving beyond the need for these metaphysical spankings from the superego. We don't need messiahs or flying saucers if we can become responsible for our destiny.
I think I have had contact with another life form. I feel like an animal that's been tagged by a scientist. I don't know whether to feel violated or especially chosen. I've thought of these things as threatening, but now I think of them as, I like using the term that my son did, guardians, or even angels.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and so it's all the same to me. I think I'll just let the mystery be.
It's like an Indian tradition to smudge with tobacco.
Yeah, with smudge.
Tell me about that.
You just kind of wash yourself with the smoke, and then what you do is that I asked the Great Spirit for safety and guidance for this trip.
August 1992, Woodinville, Washington.
And on this six-day hike, I got scratched up a lot and my feet hurt, and sometimes I just felt like I just wanted to go home, but my friends around me have told me that just to keep on going, and that's what brought me through it.
My name is Victoria. I'm 12 years old.
My name is Lee Emmerich, and I'm 12, and I come from the Chicago area, Schaumburg, Illinois.
16, 12, and 13-year-olds attend a three-week rite of passage retreat in Northwest Washington to challenge themselves physically, mentally, and spiritually, and to acknowledge their passage from childhood to youth. The retreat is sponsored by the Institute of Cultural Affairs.
My name is Stan Crow. I am the director of this Rites of Passage program. The idea of this really is to help a child do the kind of reflection that is helpful in terms of rethinking the change that's going on in them. This is the time, what we know from brain-mind research is, this is the time when the corpus callosum has finally connected. The brain is complete in terms of its development. They're able to do reflection in a way that they have not been able to do before, because the brain can access either side or any part of the brain now. And so this is the time for reflection really to be pushed.
Also, we have like a 24-hour vigil where we're all by ourselves and we fast. And we're about to do a sweat lodge, and the sweat lodge is like a preparation for the vigil.
Can you tell me, first of all, what you're wearing around your necks?
They're prayer ties, and you take a pinch of tobacco, it's a square cloth, put it in the center, and you tie it up. You bring the four corners together or something, and you make a little pouch. And you close your eyes or whatever you like to do, and you say your prayer, and you put that thought into your prayer tie, and then you tie it up. After sweat lodge, you come out to the fire here where the rocks are being heated up, and in turn you toss your personal prayer ties into the fire.
Black represents the death of something that you want to leave behind.
As you go from childhood to adolescence.
Remember, this is for you. Are you ready for your vigil? What happens in here, I have very little to do with. And what you put into this, you get back. So put a lot into it. Push yourself 10% further than you think you want to go, but no further than 10%. And we pray here for good intent on the part of all of us and give you a chance to get really cleansed and to get yourself ready for this vigil time.
It's a time to think about, okay, I've been a child. What is going to lie ahead? I don't want to give up some of my childishness, my playfulness, some of those things. At the same time, there have been some things that have been no longer appropriate for me as I move into youth. And so, what are the responsibilities I'm going to take on, as well as the privileges that I'm going to get as I become a youth?
The Institute of Cultural Affairs also conducts vision quests for young adults in the wilderness of the Pacific Northwest. It's a Native American tradition. Young people would leave their villages and go out into the wilderness alone to wait for some sort of insight or guidance. Chris Wade was one of the Institute's vision quests participants.
There were 9 of us. We all had different ideas about why we had come. One of our first ritual assignments was automatic drawing. Without thinking about it, painting a picture of the life that we were leaving behind. I drew myself, as a stick figure with no hands, no feet, and no neck. I interpreted this to mean that I felt cut off from my feelings and the world around me. I thought about this image quite a bit on the trip, hiking through the Cascade Mountains, and especially on my solitary vigil. This was the part of the trip where we were each sent out into the desert for 3 days with no food. We had to stay in one place and wait for a vision. I sat on my sleeping bag near a few scraggly pines, hoping that something spectacular would happen and answer all of my questions and solve all of my problems. It didn't. I got bored and hungry, but then I didn't have to worry about anything either. Certainly not finding food. I was just able to sit and think about things and observe the world around me. On the third night, we were supposed to build a 4-foot circle of stones and stay awake inside it until sunrise. I had never watched the stars make their entire slow journey through the sky. It rained a couple of times, but I stayed and huddled inside my circle, cold and wet, tired and hungry, absolutely alone. But after a while, all I could feel was the stillness of the night. It's been almost 4 months now since my vision quest. A couple of nights ago, I tried my hand at another self-portrait. This one has mountains and a lake, some sun overhead, and some clouds. But the funny thing about it is that I'm not even in the picture. I'm here in front, gazing out at the world and beyond. That's one of the things I started to learn on my trip. That if I focus too much on my own problems and inadequacies, I miss so much of what life has to offer. Early on the last morning of my vision quest, before sunrise, a raven soared just above my head. The Native Americans say that raven flies between the material and spirit realms. For a moment, I glimpsed its view of the world. And it was simple, awesome, and beautiful.
This final piece is an essay sent in by Jean Eisenhower, an environmental activist and writer from Tucson.
I'm not looking forward to dying, but when I go, I'd prefer it be by mountain lion. Death should be a last experience of life, Not one more experience of technology, whether fast as in a car crash or slow as in needles and tubes and monitors beeping and motors keeping organs alive for years. No, I can think of no better way to go than knowing I am at that very moment sustaining the life of another living being, especially one which finds it ever harder to live because of my species, especially one as beautiful as a mountain lion. My grandmother I have been watching go for a full 15 years, the last 10 of which she has seemed to have no recognition of sound or movement or her very own life, much less recognition of people or her family or their caring for her. I have notified my family that if the time comes I'm like my grandmother or otherwise unable to respond to others and care for myself, I want to go on a vision quest. They are to take me deep into whatever mountain range is convenient and help me to the highest possible place far off the trail within the mountain lion's seasonal habitat. There we may have a ceremony, then they may hug me, wish me a good journey, and go away. Leave me no food and no shoes. I do want a good sleeping bag since I can't tolerate the cold, but leave me no tent. If you want, you may come back in 2 weeks or so to gather my remains or simply verify I am gone, but you are not to come back sooner or try to change my course. I may die of cold or starvation or even a fall should I be ambulatory and try to hike around, but the most glorious way to die, if I am lucky, will be by major predator, such as the mountain lion. Perhaps I would be surprised as in a flash a lion would be at my neck. Or maybe, despite failing faculties, my senses would come alive in the solitude and silence of the wilderness, and I would smell and hear as sensitively as wild things. Sitting or lying quiet, I might hear the cat from a distance, stop, then slowly approach, pad settling softly on the forest duff, its breathing intermixed with the breeze. Then the charge. Before it broke my neck, perhaps a low sound would emerge from deep in the cat to my ear, anticipating its satiation. Fur on my neck like a lover, almost purring, paws embracing, its stomach and intestines even then churning chemicals to digest my flesh. Its heart would beat strongly then, slow and healthy, perhaps 60 beats per minute, beating patiently after mine had ceased, as the owner licks its paws and cleans its face, then departs to nap, the way it has for thousands of years.
Some say once gone, you're gone forever, and some say you're gonna come back. Some say you rest in the arms of the Savior if in sinful ways you lack. Some say that they're coming back in a garden, bunch of carrots and little sweet. Out, yes, let the mystery be.
If you'd like information about any of the pieces you heard on this program,
or if you'd like to find out about contributing your tape to Earth on the Air,
write to us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145.
Earth on the Air is produced by Peter Maloff and Suzanne Tedesco. Our engineer is Eric Bowerman.
Additional production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, the Dudley Foundation, and listener members like you.
And special thanks to KUOW and KCMU in Seattle, the Dub Train cassette duplicating services, and all the Earth on the Air volunteers and staff.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you're interested in show number 29. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Peter Maloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.